cheeks shaking. Mr. Casey struggled up from his chair and bent across the table towards her, scraping the air from before his eyes with one hand as though he were tearing aside a cobweb. "No God for Ireland," he cried. "We have had too much God in Ireland. Away with God."
"Blasphemer, devil," screamed Dante,
starting to her feet and almost spitting in his face. Uncle Charles and Mr. Dedalus pulled Mr. Casey back into his chair again, talking to him from both sides reasonably. He stared before him out of his dark flaming eyes, repeating, "Away with God, I say." Dante shoved her chair violently aside and left the table, upsetting her napkin ring, which rolled slowly along the carpet and came to rest against the foot of an easy chair. Mrs. Dedalus rose quickly and followed her towards the door. At the door, Dante turned round violently and shouted down the room, her cheeks flushed and quivering with rage.
"Devil out of hell! We won! We crushed him to death! Fiend!"
The door slammed behind her. Mr. Casey, freeing his arms from his holders, suddenly bowed his head on his hands with a sob of pain.
"Poor Parnell," he cried loudly. "My dead king!"
He sobbed loudly and bitterly. Stephen, raising his terror-stricken face, saw that his father's eyes were full of tears. The fellows talked together in little groups. One fellow said, "They were caught near the Hill of Lions."
"Who caught them?"
"Mr. Gleeson and the minister. They were on a car,"
the same fellow added.
"A fellow in the higher line told me."
Fleming asked,
"But why did they run away? Tell us."
"I know why," Cecil Thunder said. "Because they had fecked cash out of the rector's room."
"Who fecked it?"
"Kickham's brother. And they all went shares in it."
"But that was stealing. How could they have done that?"
"A fat lot you know about it, Thunder," Wells said. "I know why they scut.
Tell us why."
"I was told not to," Wells said.
"Oh, go on, Wells," all said. "You might tell us. We won't let it out."
Stephen bent forward, his head to hear. Wells looked round to see if anyone was coming. Then he said secretly,
"You know the altar wine they keep in the press, in the sacristy?"
"Yes."
"Well, they drank that, and it was found out who did it by the smell. And that's why they ran away, if you want to know."
And the fellow who had spoken first said,
"Yes, that's what I heard too from the fellow in the higher line."
The fellows all were silent. Stephen stood among them, afraid to speak, listening. A faint sickness of awe made him feel weak. How could they have done that? He thought of the dark, silent sacristy. There were dark wooden presses there where the crimped surplices lay quietly folded. It was not the chapel, but still you had to speak under your breath. It was a holy place. He remembered the summer evening he had been there to be dressed as boat-bearer, the evening of the procession to the little altar in the wood. A strange and holy place. The boy that held the censer had swung it lifted by the middle chain to keep the coals lighting. That was called charcoal, and it had burned quietly as the fellow had swung it gently and had given off a weak, sour smell. And then, when all were vested, he had stood holding out the boat to the rector, and the rector had put a spoonful of incense in it, and it had hissed on the red coals. The fellows were talking together in little groups here and there on the playground. The fellow seemed to him to have grown smaller. That was because a sprinter had knocked him down the day before, a fellow out of second of grammar. He had been thrown by the fellow's machine lightly on the cinder path, and his spectacles had been broken in three pieces, and some of the grit of the cinders had gone into his mouth. That was why the fellow seemed to him smaller and farther away, and the goalposts so thin and far and the soft grey sky so high up. But there was no play on the football grounds, for cricket was coming, and some said that Barnes would be prof, and some said it would be Flowers. And all over the playgrounds they were playing rounders and bowling twisters and lobs. And from here and from there came the sounds of the cricket bats through the soft grey air. They said pick, pack, pock, puck. Little drops of water in a fountain slowly falling in the brimming bowl. Athai, who had been silent, said quietly,
"You are all wrong."
All turned towards him eagerly.
"Why?"
"Do you know?"
"Who told you?"
"Tell us, Athai." Athai pointed across the playground to where Simon Moonan was walking by himself, kicking a stone before him.
"Ask him," he said.
The fellows looked there and then said, "Why him?
Is he in it?"
Athai lowered his voice and said,
"Do you know why those fellows scut? I will tell you, but you must not let on you know."
"Tell us, Athai, go on. You might if you know."
He paused for a moment and then said mysteriously,
"They were caught with Simon Moonan and Tusker Boyle in the square one night."
The fellows looked at him and asked, "Caught? What doing?" Athai said,
"Smugging."
All the fellows were silent, and Athai said,
"And that's why."
Stephen looked at the faces of the fellows, but they were all looking across the playground. He wanted to ask somebody about it. What did that mean about the smugging in the square? Why did the five fellows out of the higher line run away for that? It was a joke, he thought. Simon Moonan had nice clothes, and one night he had shown him a ball of creamy sweets that the fellows of the football 15 had rolled down to him along the carpet in the middle of the refectory when he was at the door. It was the night of the match against the Bective Rangers, and the ball was made just like a red and green apple, only it opened and it was full of the creamy sweets. And one day Boyle had said that an elephant had two tuskers instead of two tusks, and that was why he was called Tusker Boyle. But some fellows called him Lady Boyle because he was always at his nails, paring them. Eileen had long, thin, cool, white hands too, because she was a girl. They were like ivory, only soft. That was the meaning of Tower of Ivory, but Protestants could not understand it and made fun of it. One day he had stood beside her looking into the hotel grounds. A waiter was running up a trail of bunting on the flagstaff, and a fox terrier was scampering to and fro on the sunny lawn. She had put her hand into his pocket where his hand was, and he had felt how cool and thin and soft her hand was. She had said that pockets were funny things to have. And then all of a sudden she had broken away and had run laughing down the sloping curve of the path. Her fair hair had streamed out behind her like gold in the sun. Tower of Ivory. House of Gold. By thinking of things, you could understand them. But why in the square? You went there when you wanted to do something. It was all thick slabs of slate, and water trickled all day out of tiny pinholes, and there was a queer smell of stale water there. And behind the door of one of the closets, there was a drawing in red pencil of a bearded man in a Roman dress with a brick in each hand, and underneath was the name of the drawing. Balbus was building a wall. Some fellow had drawn it there for a cod. It had a funny face, but it was very like a man with a beard. And on the wall of another closet, there was written in backhand, in beautiful writing, "Julius Caesar wrote the Calico Belly." Perhaps that's why they were there, because it was a place where some fellows wrote things for cod. But all the same, it was queer what Athai said and the way he said it. It was not a cod because they had run away. He looked with the others across the playground and began to feel afraid. At last Fleming said, "And we are all to be punished for what other fellows did?"
"I won't come back. See if I do," Cecil Thunder said.
"3 days silence in the refectory and sending us up for 6 and 8 every minute?"
"Yes," said Wells.
"And old Barrett has a new way of twisting the note so that you can't open it and fold it again to see how many ferali you are to get. I won't come back too."
"Yes," said Cecil Thunder. "And the prefect of studies was in second of grammar this morning."
"Let us get up a rebellion," Fleming said. "Will we?"
All the fellows were silent. The air was very silent, and you could hear the cricket bats, but more slowly than before. Pick, pock. Wells asked,
"What is going to be done to them?"
"Simon Moonan and Tusker are going to be flogged," Athai said. "And the fellows in the higher line got their choice of flogging or being expelled."
"And which are they taking?" asked the fellow who had spoken first.
"All are taking expulsion, except Corrigan," Athai answered. "He's going to be flogged by Mr. Gleason."
"I know why," Cecil Thunder said. "He is right and the other fellows are wrong, because a flogging wears off after a bit, but a fellow that has been expelled from college is known all his life on account of it. Besides,
Gleason won't flog him hard. It's best of his play not to, Fleming said.
I wouldn't like to be Simon Moonan and Tusker, Cecil Thunder said. But I don't believe they will be flogged. Perhaps they will be sent up for twice nine.
No, no, said Athai. They'll both get it on the vital spot.
Wells rubbed himself and said in a crying voice,
Please, sir, let me off.
Athai grinned and turned up the sleeves of his jacket, saying,
It can't be helped, it must be done, so down with your breeches and out with your bum.
The fellows laughed, but he felt that they were a little afraid. In the silence of the soft grey air he heard the cricket bats from here and from there, puck. That was a sound to hear, but if you were hit then, you would feel a pain. The pandy bat made a sound too, but not like that. The fellow said it was made of whalebone and leather with lead inside, and he wondered what was the pain like. There were different kinds of sounds. A long, thin cane would have a high whistling sound, and he wondered what was that pain like. It made him shivery to think of it and cold. And what Athai said too. But what was there to laugh at in it? It made him shivery, but that was because you always felt like a shiver when you let down your trousers. It was the same in the bath when you undressed yourself. He wondered who had to let them down, the master or the boy himself. Oh, how could they laugh about it that way? He looked at Athai's rolled up sleeves and knuckly, inky hands. He had rolled up his sleeves to show how Mr. Gleason would roll up his sleeves. But Mr. Gleason had round, shiny cuffs and clean white wrists and fattish white hands, and the nails of them were long and pointed. Perhaps he pared them too, like Lady Boyle. But they were terribly long and pointed nails. So long and cruel they were, though the white fattish hands were not cruel but gentle. And though he trembled with cold and fright to think of the long cruel nails and of the high whistling sound of the cane and of the chill you felt at the end of your shirt when you undressed yourself, yet he felt a feeling of queer, quiet pleasure inside him to think of the white, fattish hands, clean and strong and gentle. And he thought of what Cecil Thunder had said, that Mr. Gleason would not flog Corrigan hard. And Fleming had said he would not because it was best of his play not to. But that was not why. A voice from far out on the playground cried,
All in!
And other voices cried,
All in! All in!
During the writing lesson, he sat with his arms folded, listening to the slow scraping of the pens. Mr. Harford went to and fro, making little signs in red pencil and sometimes sitting beside the boy to show him how to hold his pen. He had tried to spell out the headline for himself. Though he knew already what it was for, it was the last of his book. Zeal without prudence is like a ship adrift. But the lines of the letters were like fine invisible threads, and it was only by closing his right eye tight and staring out of the left eye that he could make out the full curves of the capital. But Mr. Harford was very decent and never got into a wax. All the other masters got into dreadful waxes. But why were they to suffer for what fellows in the higher line did? Wells had said that they had drunk some of the altar wine out of the press in the sacristy and that it had been found out who had done it by the smell. Perhaps they had stolen a monstrance to run away with and sell it somewhere. That must have been a terrible sin. To go in there quietly at night. To open the dark press and steal the flashing gold thing into which God was put on the altar in the middle of flowers and candles at benediction, while the incense went up in clouds at both sides as the fellow swung the censer and Dominic Kelly sang the first part by himself in the choir. But God was not in it, of course, when they stole it. But still it was strange, and a great sin even to touch it. He thought of it with deep awe. A terrible and strange sin. It thrilled him to think of it in the silence when the pens scraped lightly. But to drink the altar wine out of the press and be found by the smell was a sin too. But it was not terrible and strange. It only made you feel a little sickish on account of the smell of the wine. Because on the day when he had made his first Holy Communion in the chapel, he had shut his eyes and opened his mouth and put out his tongue a little. And when the rector had stooped down to give him the Holy Communion, he had smelt a faint, winey smell of the rector's breath after the wine of the Mass. The word was beautiful. Wine. It made you think of dark purple because the grapes were dark purple that grew in Greece outside houses like white temples. But the faint smell of the rector's breath had made him feel a sick feeling on the morning of his first communion. The day of your first communion was the happiest day of your life. and once a lot of generals had asked Napoleon what was the happiest day of his life. They thought he would say the day he won some great battle or the day he was made an emperor, but he said, "Gentlemen, the happiest day of my life was the day on which I made my first Holy Communion." Father Arnall came in, and the Latin lesson began, and he remained still, leaning on the desk with his arms folded. Father Arnall gave out the theme books, and he said that they were scandalous, and that they were all to be written out again with the corrections at once. But the worst of all was Fleming's theme, because the pages were stuck together by a blot, and Father Arnall held it up by a corner and said it was an insult to any master to send him up such a theme. Then he asked Jack Lawton to decline the noun mare, and Jack Lawton stopped at the ablative singular and could not go on with the plural.
"You should be ashamed of yourself," said Father Arnall sternly. "You, the leader of the class."
Then he asked the next boy, and the next, and the next. Nobody knew. Father Arnall became very quiet, more and more quiet as each boy tried to answer it and could not. But his face was black-looking, and his eyes were staring, though his voice was so quiet. Then he asked Fleming, and Fleming said that the word had no plural. Father Arnall suddenly shut the book and shouted at him,
"Kneel out there in the middle of the class. You are one of the idlest boys I ever met. Copy out your themes again, the rest of you."
Fleming moved heavily out of his place and knelt between the two last benches. The other boys bent over their theme books and began to write. A silence filled the classroom, and Stephen, glancing timidly at Father Arnall's dark face, saw that it was a little red from the wax he was in. Was that a sin for Father Arnall to be in a wax? Or was he allowed to get into a wax when the boys were idle because that made them study better, or was he only letting on to be in a wax? It was because he was allowed, because a priest would know what a sin was and would not do it. But if he did it one time by mistake, what would he do to go to confession? Perhaps he would go to confession to the minister, and if the minister did it, he would go to the rector, and the rector to the provincial, and the provincial to the general of the Jesuits. That was called the order, and he has heard his father say that they were all clever men. They could all have become high up people in the world if they had not become Jesuits. And he wondered what Father Arnall and Paddy Barrett would have become, and what Mr. McGlade and Mr. Gleeson would have become if they had not become Jesuits. It was hard to think what, because you would have to think of them in a different way, with different coloured coats, and trousers, and with beards, and moustaches, and different kinds of hats. The door opened quietly and closed. A quick whisper ran through the class. The Prefect of Studies. There was an instant of dead silence, and then the loud crack of a pandy bat on the last desk. Stephen's heart leapt up in fear.
"Any boys want flogging here, Father Arnall?" cried the Prefect of Studies. "Any lazy, idle loafers that want flogging in this class?"
He came to the middle of the class and saw Fleming on his knees.
"Ho, ho," he cried. "Who is this boy? Why is he on his knees? What is your name, boy?"
"Fleming, sir."
"Ho, ho, Fleming. An idler, of course. I can see it in your eye. Why is he on his knees, Father Arnall?"
"He wrote a bad Latin theme," Father Arnall said, "and he missed all the questions in grammar."
"Of course he did," cried the Prefect of Studies. "Of course he did. A born idler. I can see it in the corner of his eye."
He banged his pandy bat down on the desk and cried,
"Up, Fleming. Up, my boy."
Fleming stood up slowly.
"Hold out,"
cried the Prefect of Studies. Fleming held out his hand. The pandy bat came down on it with a loud smacking sound. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
"Other hand."
The pandy bat came down again in 6 loud, quick smacks.
"Kneel down,"
cried the Prefect of Studies. Fleming knelt down, squeezing his hands under his armpits, his face contorted with pain. But Stephen knew how hard his hands were because Fleming was always rubbing rosin into them. But perhaps he was in great pain, for the noise of the pandy bat was terrible. Stephen's heart was beating and fluttering.
"At your work, all of you," shouted the Prefect of Studies. "We want no lazy, idle loafers here. Lazy, idle little schemers. At your work, I tell you. Father Dolan will be in to see you every day. Father Dolan will be in tomorrow."
He poked one of the boys in the side with his pandy bat, saying, "You boy, when will Father Dolan be in again?"
Tomorrow, sir,
said Tom Furlong's voice.
Tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, said the prefect of studies. Make up your minds for that. Every day, Father Dolan. Right away. You, boy, who are you?
Stephen's heart jumped suddenly.
Daedalus, sir.
Why are you not writing like the others?
He could not speak with fright.
Why is he not writing, Father Arnall?
He broke his glasses, said Father Arnall, and I exempted him from work.
Broke? What is this I hear? What is this your name is?
Said the prefect of studies.
Daedalus, sir.
Out here, Daedalus, lazy little schemer. I see schemer in your face. Where did you break your glasses?
Stephen stumbled into the middle of the class, blinded by fear and haste.
Where did you break your glasses? Repeated the prefect of studies.
The cinder path, sir.
The cinder path, cried the prefect of studies. I know that trick.
Stephen lifted his eyes in wonder and saw for a moment Father Dolan's white, grey, not young face, his baldy, white-grey head with fluff at the sides of it, the steel rims of his spectacles, and his no-coloured eyes looking through the glasses. Why did he say he knew that trick?
Lazy, idle, little loafer, cried the prefect of studies. Broke my glasses, an old schoolboy trick. Out with your hand this moment.
Stephen closed his eyes and held out in the air his trembling hand with the palm upwards. He felt the prefect of studies touch it for a moment at the fingers to straighten it, and then the swish of the sleeve of the soutane as the pandy bat was lifted to strike. A hot, burning, stinging, tingling blow like the loud crack of a broken stick made his trembling hand crumple together like a leaf in the fire, and at the sound and the pain, scalding tears were driven into his eyes. His whole body was shaking with fright. His arm was shaking and his crumpled, burning, livid hand shook like a loose leaf in the air. A cry sprang to his lips. A prayer to be let off. But though the tears scalded his eyes and his limbs quivered with pain and fright, he held back the hot tears and the cry that scalded his throat.
Other hand! Shouted the prefect of studies.
Stephen drew back his maimed and quivering right arm and held out his left hand. The soutane sleeve swished again as the pandy bat was lifted, and a loud crashing sound and a fierce, maddening, tingling, burning pain made his hand shrink together with the palms and fingers in a livid, quivering mass. The scalding water burst forth from his eyes, and burning with shame and agony and fear, he drew back his shaking arm in terror and burst out into a whine of pain. His body shook with a palsy of fright, and in shame and rage he felt a scalding cry come from his throat and the scalding tears falling out of his eyes and down his flaming cheeks.
"Kneel down!" cried the prefect of studies.
Stephen knelt down quickly, pressing his beaten hands to his sides. To think of them beaten and swollen with pain all in a moment made him feel so sorry for them, as if they were not his own but someone else's that he had felt sorry for. And as he knelt, calming the last sobs in his throat and feeling the burning, tingling pain pressed into his sides, he thought of the hands which he had held out in the air with the palms up, and of the firm touch of the prefect of studies when he had steadied the shaking fingers, and of the beaten, swollen, reddened mass of palm and fingers that shook helplessly in the air.
"Get at your work, all of you," cried the prefect of studies from the door. "Father Dolan will be in every day to see if any boy, any lazy, idle little loafer wants flogging. Every day. Every day."
The door closed behind him. The hushed class continued to copy out the themes. Father Arnall rose from his seat and went among them, helping the boys with gentle words and telling them the mistakes they had made. His voice was very gentle and soft. Then he returned to his seat and said to Fleming and Stephen,
"You may return to your places, you two."
Fleming and Stephen rose and, walking to their seats, sat down. Stephen, scarlet with shame, opened a book quickly with one weak hand and bent down upon it, his face close to the page. It was unfair and cruel because the doctor had told him not to read without glasses, and he had written home to his father that morning to send him a new pair. And Father Arnall had said that he need not study till the new glasses came. then to be called a schemer before the class, and to be pandied when he always got the card for first or second and was the leader of the Yorkists? How could the prefect of studies know that it was a trick? He felt the touch of the prefect's fingers as they had steadied his hand, and at first he had thought he was going to shake hands with them because the fingers were soft and firm. But then, in an instant, he had heard the swish of the soutane sleeve and the crash. It was cruel and unfair to make him kneel in the middle of the class then, and Father Arnall had told them both that they might return to their places without making any difference between them. He listened to Father Arnall's low and gentle voice as he corrected the themes. Perhaps he was sorry now, and wanted to be decent. But it was unfair and cruel. The prefect of studies was a priest, but that was cruel and unfair. And his white-grey face and the no-coloured eyes behind the steel-rimmed spectacles were cruel-looking because he had steadied the hand first with his firm, soft fingers, and that was to hit it better and louder.
"It's a stinking mean thing, that's what it is," said Fleming in the corridor as the classes were passing out and filed to the refectory. "To pandy a fellow for what is not his fault." "You really broke your glasses by accident, didn't you?" Nasty Roach asked.
Stephen felt his heart filled by Fleming's words and did not answer.
"Of course he did," said Fleming. "I wouldn't stand it. I'd go up and tell the rector on him."
"Yes," said Cecil Thunder eagerly, "and I saw him lift the panty bat over his shoulder, and he's not allowed to do that."
"Did they hurt you much?" Nasty Roach asked.
"Very much," Stephen said.
"I wouldn't stand it," Fleming repeated. "From Baldy Head or any other Baldy Head. It's a stinking mean low trick, that's what it is. I'd go straight up to the rector and tell him about it after dinner."
Yes, do," said Cecil Thunder.
"Yes, do, yes, go up and tell the rector on him, Dedalus," said Nasty Roach. "Because he said that he'd come in tomorrow again and pandy you."
"Yes, yes, tell the rector," all said.
And there were some fellows out of second of grammar listening, and one of them said, "The Senate and the Roman people declared that Dedalus had been wrongly punished." It was wrong. It was unfair and cruel, and, as he sat in the refectory, he suffered time after time in memory the same humiliation until he began to wonder whether it might not really be that there was something in his face which made him look like a schemer, and he wished he had a little mirror to see. But there could not be, and it was unjust and cruel and unfair. He could not eat the blackish fish fritters they got on Wednesdays in Lent, and one of his potatoes had the mark of the spade in it. Yes, he would do what the fellows had told him. He would go up and tell the rector that he had been wrongly punished. A thing like that had been done before by somebody in history, by some great person whose head was in the books of history. And the rector would declare that he had been wrongly punished because the Senate and the Roman people always declared that the men who did that had been wrongly punished. Those were the great men whose names were in Richmal Magnall's questions. History was all about those men and what they did, and that was what Peter Parley's tales about Greece and Rome were all about. Peter Parley himself was on the first page in a picture. There was a road over a heath with grass at the side and little bushes, and Peter Parley had a broad hat like a Protestant minister and a big stick, and he was walking fast along the road to Greece and Rome. It was easy what he had to do. All he had to do was when the dinner was over and he came out in his turn to go on walking, but not out to the corridor, but up the staircase on the right that led to the castle. He had nothing to do but that. To turn to the right and walk fast up the staircase, and in half a minute he would be in the low, dark, narrow corridor that led through the castle to the rector's room. And every fellow had said that it was unfair, even the fellow out of second of grammar who had said that about the Senate and the Roman people. What would happen? He heard the fellows of the higher line stand up at the top of the refectory and heard their steps as they came down the matting. Paddy Rath and Jimmy McGee and the Spaniard and the Portuguese, and the fifth was Big Corrigan, who was going to be flogged by Mr. Gleason. That was why the prefect of studies had called him a schemer and pandied him for nothing. And straining his weak eyes, tired with the tears, he watched Big Corrigan's broad shoulders and big hanging black head passing in the file. But he had done something. And besides, Mr. Gleason would not flog him hard, and he remembered how Big Corrigan looked in the bath. He had skin the same colour as the turf-coloured bog water in the shallow end of the bath, and when he walked along the side his feet slapped loudly on the wet tiles, and at every step his thighs shook a little because he was fat.
The refectory was half empty and the fellows were still passing out in file. He could go up the staircase because there was never a priest or a prefect outside the refectory door. But he could not go. The rector would side with the prefect of studies and think it was a schoolboy trick, and then the prefect of studies would come in every day the same, only it would be worse, because he would be dreadfully waxy at any fellow going up to the rector about him. The fellows had told him to go, but they would not go themselves. They had forgotten all about it. No, it was best to forget all about it, and perhaps the prefect of studies had only said he would come in. No, it was best to hide out of the way, because when you were small and young, you could often escape that way. The fellows at his table stood up. He stood up and passed out among them in file. He had to decide. He was coming near the door. If he went on with the fellows, he could never go up to the rector because he could not leave the playground for that. And if he went and was pandied all the same, all the fellows would make fun and talk about young Dedalus going up to the rector to tell on the prefect of studies. He was walking down along the matting, and he saw the door before him. It was impossible. He could not. He thought of the baldy head of the prefect of studies with the cruel, no-coloured eyes looking at him, and he heard the voice of the prefect of studies asking him twice what his name was. Why could he not remember the name when he was told the first time? Was he not listening the first time, or was it to make fun out of the name? The great men in the history had names like that, and nobody made fun of them. It was his own name that he should have made fun of if he wanted to make fun. Dolan. It was like the name of a woman who washed clothes. He had reached the door and, turning quickly up to the right, walked up the stairs, and before he could make up his mind to come back, he had entered the low, dark, narrow corridor that led to the castle. And as he crossed the threshold of the door of the corridor, he saw, without turning his head to look, that all the fellows were looking after him as they went filing by. He passed along the narrow, dark corridor, passing little doors that were the doors of the rooms of the community. He peered in front of him and right and left through the gloom and thought that those must be portraits. It was dark and silent and his eyes were weak and tired with tears so that he could not see. But he thought they were the portraits of the saints and great men of the order who were looking down on him silently as he passed. Saint Ignatius Loyola holding an open book and pointing to the words Ad Maiorum Dei Gloriam in it. Saint Francis Xavier pointing to his chest. Lorenzo Ricci with his beretta on his head like one of the prefects of the lines, the three patrons of holy youth. Saint Stanislaus Kostka, Saint Aloysius Gonzago, and blessed John Birchmans, all with young faces because they died when they were young, and Father Peter Kenny sitting in a chair wrapped in a big cloak. He came out on the landing above the entrance hall and looked about him. That was where Hamilton Rowan had passed and the marks of the soldier's slugs were there. And it was there that the old servants had seen the ghost in the white cloak of a marshal. An old servant was sweeping at the end of the landing. He asked him where was the rector's room, and the old servant pointed to the door at the far end and looked after him as he went onto it and knocked. There was no answer. He knocked again more loudly, and his heart jumped when he heard a muffled voice say, "Come in." He turned the handle and opened the door and fumbled for the handle of the green baize door inside. He found it and pushed it open and went in. He saw the rector sitting at a desk writing. There was a skull on the desk and a strange solemn smell in the room like the old leather of chairs. His heart was beating fast on account of the solemn place he was in and the silence of the room, and he looked at the skull and at the rector's kind looking face.
"Well, my little man," said the rector,
"what is it?"
Stephen swallowed down the thing in his throat and said, "I broke my glasses, sir." The rector opened his mouth and said,
"Oh."
Then he smiled and said,
"Well, if we broke our glasses, we must ride home for a new pair."
"I wrote home, sir," said Stephen. "And Father Arnall said I am not to study till they come."
"Quite right," said the rector.
Stephen swallowed down the thing again and tried to keep his legs and his voice from shaking. "But, sir..."
"Yes?"
"Father Dolan came in today and pandied me because I was not writing my theme." The rector looked at him in silence, and he could feel the blood rising to his face and the tears about to rise to his eyes. The rector said,
"Your name is Dedalus, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir."
"And where did you break your glasses?"
"On the cinder path, sir." A fellow was coming out of the bicycle house, and I fell and they got broken. I don't know the fellow's name. The rector looked at him again in silence. Then he smiled and said,
Oh, well, it was a mistake. I'm sure Father Dolan did not know.
But I told him I broke them, sir, and he pandied me.
Did you tell him that you had written home for a new pair?
The rector asked.
No, sir. Oh, well then, said the rector, Father Dolan did not understand. You can say that I excuse you from your lessons for a few days.
Stephen said quickly for fear his trembling voice would prevent him.
Yes, sir, but Father Dolan said he will come in tomorrow to pandy me again for it. Very well, the rector said. It is a mistake, and I shall speak to Father Dolan myself. Will that do now?
Stephen felt the tears wetting his eyes, and murmured,
Oh, yes, sir. Thanks.
The rector held his hand across the side of the desk where the skull was, and Stephen, placing his hand in it for a moment, felt a cool, moist palm.
Good day now, said the rector, withdrawing his hand and bowing.
Good day, sir, said Stephen. He bowed and walked quietly out of the room, closing the doors carefully and slowly. But when he had passed the old servant at the landing and was again in the low, narrow, dark corridor, he began to walk faster and faster. Faster and faster he hurried on through the gloom excitedly. He bumped his elbow against the door at the end and, hurrying down the staircase, walked quickly through the two corridors and out into the air. He could hear the cries of the fellows on the playgrounds. He broke into a run, and running quicker and quicker, ran across the cinder path and reached the third line playground, panting. The fellows had seen him running. They closed round him in a ring, pushing one against another to hear.
Tell us! Tell us! What did he say?
Did you go in?
What did he say? Tell us! Tell us!
He told them what he had said, and what the rector had said, and when he had told them, all the fellows flung their caps, spinning up into the air and cried,
Hurroo!
They caught their caps and sent them up again, spinning sky high, and cried again, Hurroo!
Hurroo!
They made a cradle of their locked hands and hoisted him up among them and carried him along till he struggled to get free. And when he had escaped from them, they broke away in all directions, flinging their caps again into the air and whistling as they went, spinning up and crying,
Hurroo!
And they gave three groans for Baldy Head Dolan and three cheers for Con Me, and they said he was the decentest rector that was ever in Clongowes. The cheers died away in the soft grey air. He was alone. He was happy and free, but he would not be anyway proud with Father Dolan. He would be very quiet and obedient, and he wished that he could do something kind for him to show him that he was not proud. The air was soft and grey and mild, and evening was coming. There was the smell of evening in the air, the smell of the fields in the country where they digged up turnips to peel them and eat them. When they went out for a walk to Major Barton's, the smell there was in the little wood beyond the pavilion where the gallnuts were. The fellows were practicing long shies and bowling lobs and slow twisters. In the soft grey silence he could hear the bump of the balls, and from here and from there through the quiet air the sound of the cricket bats, pick, pack, pock, puck, like drops of water in a fountain falling softly in the brimming bowl. Chapter 2 Uncle Charles smoked such black twist that at last his nephew suggested him to enjoy his morning smoke in a little outhouse at the end of the garden.
Very good, Simon. All serene, Simon, said the old man tranquilly. Anywhere you like. The outhouse will do me nicely. It will be more salubrious.
Damn me, said Mr. Dedalus frankly, if I know how you can smoke such villainous awful tobacco. It's like gunpowder, by God.
It's very nice, Simon, replied the old man.
Very cool and mollifying.
Every morning, therefore, Uncle Charles repaired to his outhouse, but not before he had greased and brushed scrupulously his back hair and brushed and put on his tall hat. While he smoked, the brim of his tall hat and the bowl of his pipe were just visible beyond the jambs of the outhouse door. His arbor, as he called the reeking outhouse, which he shared with the cat and the garden tools, served him also as a sounding box, and every morning he hummed contentedly one of his favorite songs. Oh, twine me a bower, or Blue Eyes and Golden Hair, or The Groves of Blarney,
while the grey and blue coils of smoke rose slowly from his pipe and vanished in the pure air. During the first part of the summer in Blackrock, Uncle Charles was Stephen's constant companion. Uncle Charles was a hale old man with a well-tanned skin, rugged features, and white side whiskers. On weekdays, he did messages between the house in Carysfort Avenue and those shops in the main street of the town with which the family dealt. Stephen was glad to go with him on these errands, for Uncle Charles helped him very liberally to handfuls of whatever was exposed in open boxes and barrels outside the counter. He would seize a handful of grapes and sawdust, or three or four American apples, and thrust them generously into his grandnephew's hand, while the shopman smiled uneasily. And on Stephen's feigning reluctance to take them, he would frown and say,
"Take them, sir. Do you hear me, sir? They're good for your bowels."
When the order list had been booked, the two would go on to the park where an old friend of Stephen's father, Mike Flynn, would be found seated on a bench, waiting for them. Then would begin Stephen's run round the park. Mike Flynn would stand at the gate near the railway station, watch in hand, while Stephen ran round the track in the style Mike Flynn favoured, his head high lifted, his knees well lifted, and his hands held straight down by his sides. When the morning practice was over, the trainer would make his comments, and sometimes illustrate them by shuffling along for a yard or so comically in an old pair of blue canvas shoes. A small ring of wonderstruck children and nursemaids would gather to watch him and linger even when he and Uncle Charles had sat down again and were talking athletics and politics. Though he had heard his father say that Mike Flynn had put some of the best runners of modern times through his hands, Stephen often glanced at his trainer's flabby, stubble-covered face as it bent over the long-stained fingers through which he rolled his cigarette, and with pity at the mild, lusterless blue eyes which would look up suddenly from the task and gaze vaguely into the blue distance while long, swollen fingers ceased their rolling and grains and fibres of tobacco fell back into the pouch. On the way home, Charles would often pay a visit to the chapel and, as the font was above Stephen's reach, the old man would dip his hand and then sprinkle the water briskly about Stephen's clothes and on the floor of the porch. While he prayed, he knelt on his red handkerchief and read above his breath from a thumb-blackened prayer book, wherein catchwords were printed at the foot of every page. Stephen knelt at his side, respecting, though he did not share his piety. He often wondered what his granduncle prayed for so seriously. Perhaps he prayed for the souls in purgatory or for the grace of a happy death, or perhaps he prayed that God might send him back a part of the big fortune he had squandered in Cork. On Sundays, Stephen with his father and his granduncle took their constitutional. The old man was a nimble walker in spite of his corns, and often 10 or 12 miles of the road were covered. The little village of Stillorgan was the parting of the ways. Either they went to the left, towards the Dublin Mountains, or along the Goatstown Road and thence into Dundrum, coming home by Sandyford. Trudging along the road or standing in some grimy wayside public house, his elders spoke constantly of the subjects nearer their hearts. Of Irish politics, of Munster, and of the legends of their own family, to all of which Stephen lent an avid ear. Words which he did not understand, he said over and over to himself till he had learned them by heart, and through them he had glimpses of the real world about them. The hour when he too would take part in the life of that world seemed drawing near, and in secret he began to make ready for the great part which he felt awaited him, the nature of which he only dimly apprehended. His evenings were his own, and he pored over a ragged translation of The Count of Monte Cristo. The figure of that dark avenger stood forth in his mind for whatever he had heard or divined in childhood of the strange and terrible. At night he built up on the parlour table an image of the wonderful island cave, out of transfers and paper flowers and coloured tissue paper and strips of the silver and golden paper in which chocolate is wrapped. When he had broken up this scenery, weary of its tinsel, there would come to his mind the bright picture of Marseille, of sunny trellises, and of Mercedes. Outside Black Rock, on the road that led to the mountains, stood a small whitewashed house in the garden of which grew many rose bushes. And in this house, he told himself, another Mercedes lived. Both on the outward and on the homeward journey, he measured distance by this landmark, and in his imagination he lived through a long train of adventures, marvellous as those in the book itself, toward the close of which there appeared an image of himself, grown older and sadder, standing in a moonlit garden with Mercedes, who had so many years before slighted his love, and with a sadly proud gesture of refusal saying, "Madame, I never eat muscatel grapes." he became the ally of a boy named Aubrey Mills, and founded with him a gang of adventurers in the avenue. Aubrey carried a whistle dangling from his buttonhole and a bicycle lamp attached to his belt, while the others had short sticks thrust dagger-wise through theirs. Stephen, who had read of Napoleon's plain style of dress, chose to remain unadorned and thereby heightened for himself the pleasure of taking counsel with his lieutenant before giving orders. The gang made forays into the gardens of old maids or went down to the castle and fought a battle on the shaggy weed-grown rocks, coming home after it weary stragglers with the stale odours of the foreshore in their nostrils and the rank oils of the sea-wrack upon their hands and in their hair. Aubrey and Stephen had a common milkman, and often they drove out in the milk cart to Carrick Mines where the cows were at grass. While the men were milking, the boys would take turns in riding the tractable mare around the field. But when autumn came, the cows were driven home from the grass, and the first sight of the filthy cow yard at Stradbrook with its foul green puddles and clots of liquid dung and steaming bran troughs sickened Stephen's heart. The cattle, which had seemed so beautiful in the country on sunny days, revolted him, and he could not even look at the milk they yielded. The coming of September did not trouble him this year, for he was not to be sent back to Clongowes. The practice in the park came to an end when Mike Flynn went into hospital. Aubrey was at school and had only an hour or two free in the evening. The gang fell asunder, and there were no more nightly forays or battles on the rocks. Stephen sometimes went round with the car which delivered the evening milk, and these chilly drives blew away his memory of the filth of the cowyard, and he felt no repugnance at seeing the cow hairs and hay seeds on the milkman's coat. Whenever the car drew up before a house, he waited to catch a glimpse of a well-scrubbed kitchen, or of a softly lighted hall, and to see how the servant would hold the jug, and how she would close the door. He thought it should be a pleasant life enough, driving along the roads every evening to deliver milk, if he had warm gloves and a fat bag of ginger nuts in his pocket to eat from. But the same foreknowledge, which had sickened his heart and made his legs sag suddenly as he raced round the park, the same intuition which had made him glance with mistrust at his trainer's flabby, stubble-covered face as it bent heavily over his long-stained fingers, dissipated any vision of the future. In a vague way he understood that his father was in trouble, and that this was the reason why he himself had not been sent back to Clongowes. For some time he had felt a slight change in his house, and those changes in what he had deemed unchangeable were so many slight shocks to his boyish conception of the world. The ambition which he felt astir at times in the darkness of his soul sought no outlet. A dusk like that of the outer world obscured his mind as he heard the mare's hoofs clattering along the tram track on the rock road and the great can swaying and rattling behind him. He returned to Mercedes and, as he brooded upon her image, a strange unrest crept into his blood. Sometimes a fever gathered within him and led him to rove alone in the evening along the quiet avenue. The peace of the gardens and the kindly lights in the windows poured a tender influence into his restless heart. The noise of children at play annoyed him, and their silly voices made him feel, even more keenly than he had felt at Clongowes, that he was different from others. He did not want to play. He wanted to meet in the real world the unsubstantial image which his soul so constantly beheld. He did not know where to seek it or how, but a premonition which led him on told him that this image would, without any overt act of his, encounter him. They would meet quietly as if they had known each other and had made their tryst, perhaps at one of the gates or in some more secret place. They would be alone, surrounded by darkness and silence, and in that moment of supreme tenderness, he would be transfigured. He would fade into something impalpable under her eyes, and then in a moment, he would be transfigured. Weakness and timidity and inexperience would fall from him in that magic moment. Two great yellow caravans had halted one morning before the door, and men had come tramping into the house to dismantle it. The furniture had been hustled out through the front garden, which was strewn with wisps of straw and rope ends, and into the huge vans at the gate. When all had been safely stowed, the vans had set off noisily down the avenue, and from the window of the railway carriage in which he had sat with his red-eyed mother, Stephen had seen them lumbering along the Merrion Road. The parlour fire would not draw that evening, and Mr. Dedalus rested the poker against the bars of the grate to attract the flame. Uncle Charles dozed in a corner of the half-furnished, uncarpeted room, and near him the family portraits leaned against the wall, The lamp on the table shed a weak light over the boarded floor, muddied by the feet of the van men. Stephen sat on a footstool beside his father, listening to a long and incoherent monologue. He understood little or nothing of it at first, but he became slowly aware that his father had enemies and that some fight was going to take place. He felt, too, that he was being enlisted for the fight, that some duty was being laid upon his shoulders. The sudden flight from the comfort and reverie of Black Rock, the passage through the gloomy, foggy city, the thought of the bare, cheerless house in which they were now to live made his heart heavy. And again, an intuition, a foreknowledge of the future came to him. He understood also why the servants had often whispered together in the hall and why his father had often stood on the hearth rug with his back to the fire, talking loudly to Uncle Charles, who urged him to sit down and eat his dinner. "There's a crack of the whip left in me yet, Stephen, old chap," said Mr. Dedalus, poking at the dull fire with fierce energy. "We're not dead yet, sonny. No, by the Lord Jesus, God forgive me, not half dead." Dublin was a new and complex sensation. Uncle Charles had grown so witless that he could no longer be sent out on errands, and the disorder in settling in the new house left Stephen freer than he had been in Black Rock. In the beginning, he contented himself with circling timidly around the neighbouring square, or at most going halfway down one of the side streets, but when he had made a skeleton map of the city in his mind, he followed boldly one of his central lines until he reached the custom house. He passed unchallenged among the docks and along the quays, wondering at the multitude of corks that lay bobbing on the surface of the water in a thick, yellow scum, at the crowds of quay porters and the rumbling carts and the ill-dressed bearded policemen. The vastness and strangeness of the life suggested to him by the bales of merchandise stocked along the walls or swung aloft out of the holds of steamers wakened again in him the unrest which had sent him wandering in the evening from garden to garden in search of Mercedes. And amid this new bustling life, he might have fancied himself in another Marseille, but that he missed the bright sky and the sun-warmed trellises of the wine shops. A vague dissatisfaction grew up within him, as he looked on the quays and on the river and on the lowering skies, and yet he continued to wander up and down, day after day, as if he really sought someone that eluded him. He went once or twice with his mother to visit their relatives. And though they passed a jovial array of shops lit up and adorned for Christmas, his mood of embittered silence did not leave him. The causes of his embitterment were many, remote and near. He was angry with himself for being young, and the prey of restless, foolish impulses, angry also with the change of fortune which was reshaping the world about him into a vision of squalor and insincerity. Yet his anger lent nothing to the vision. He chronicled with patience what he saw, detaching himself from it and tasting its mortifying flavour in secret. He was sitting on the backless chair in his aunt's kitchen. A lamp with a reflector hung on the japanned wall of the fireplace, and by its light, his aunt was reading the evening paper that lay on her knees. She looked a long time at a smiling picture that was set in it and said musingly, "The beautiful Mabel Hunter." A ringleted girl stood on tiptoe to peer at the picture and said softly, "What is she in, mud?" "In a pantomime, love." The child leaned her ringleted head against her mother's sleeve, gazing on the picture, and murmured as if fascinated,
"The beautiful Mabel Hunter."
As if fascinated, her eyes rested long upon those demurely taunting eyes, and she murmured devotedly,
"Isn't she an exquisite creature?"
And the boy who came in from the street, stamping crookedly under his stone of coal, heard her words. He dropped his load promptly on the floor and hurried to her side to see. He mauled the edges of the paper with his reddened and blackened hands, shouldering her aside and complaining that he could not see. He was sitting in the narrow breakfast room high up in the old dark-windowed house. The firelight flickered on the wall, and beyond the window a spectral dust was gathering upon the river. Before the fire an old woman was busy making tea, and, as she bustled at the task, she told in a low voice of what the priest and the doctor had said. She told, too, of certain changes they had seen in her of late, and of her odd ways and sayings. He sat listening to the words and following the ways of adventure that lay open in the coals, arches, and vaults and winding galleries and jagged caverns. Suddenly, he became aware of something in the doorway. A skull appeared suspended in the gloom of the doorway. A feeble creature like a monkey was there, drawn thither by the sound of voices at the fire. A whining voice came from the door asking,
"Is that Josephine?"
The old bustling woman answered cheerily from the fireplace, "No, Ellen. It's Stephen."
Oh, good evening, Stephen.
He answered the greeting and saw a silly smile break over the face in the doorway. "Do you want anything, Ellen?" asked the old woman at the fire. But she did not answer the question and said,
"I thought it was Josephine. I thought you were Josephine, Stephen."
And repeating this several times, she fell to laughing feebly. He was sitting in the midst of a children's party at Harold's Cross. His silent, watchful manner had grown upon him, and he took little part in the games. The children, wearing the spoils of their crackers, danced and romped noisily, and though he tried to share their merriment, he felt himself a gloomy figure amid the gay cocked hats and sunbonnets. But when he had sung his song and withdrawn into a snug corner of the room, he began to taste the joy of his loneliness. The mirth, which in the beginning of the evening had seemed to him false and trivial, was like a soothing air to him, passing gaily by his senses, hiding from other eyes the feverish agitation of his blood, while through the circling of the dancers and amid the music and laughter, her glance travelled to his corner, flattering, taunting, searching, exciting his heart. In the hall, the children who had stayed latest were putting on their things. The party was over. She had thrown a shawl about her and, as they went together towards the tram, sprays of her fresh, warm breath flew gaily above her cowled head, and her shoes tapped blithely on the glassy road. It was the last tram. The lank brown horses knew it and shook their bells to the clear night in admonition. The conductor talked with the driver, both nodding often in the green light of the lamp. On the empty seats of the tram were scattered a few coloured tickets. No sound of footsteps came up or down the road. No sound broke the peace of the night, save when the lank brown horses rubbed their noses together and shook their bells. They seemed to listen, he on the upper step and she on the lower. She came up to his step many times and went down to hers again between their phrases, and once or twice stood close beside him for some moments on the upper step, forgetting to go down, and then went down. His heart danced upon her movements like a cork upon a tide. He heard what her eyes said to him from beneath their cowl, and knew that in some dim past, whether in life or reverie, he had heard their tale before. He saw her urge, her vanities, her fine dress and sash and long black stockings, and knew that he had yielded to them 1,000 times. Yet a voice within him spoke above the noise of his dancing heart, asking him would he take her gift, to which he had only to stretch out his hand. And he remembered the day when he and Eileen had stood looking into the hotel grounds, watching the waiters running up a trail of bunting on the flagstaff, and the fox terrier scampering to and fro on the sunny lawn, and how, all of a sudden, she had broken out into a peal of laughter, and had run down the sloping curve of the path. Now, as then, he stood listlessly in his place, seemingly a tranquil watcher of the scene before him. "She too wants me to catch hold of her," he thought. "That's why she came with me to the tram. I could easily catch hold of her when she comes up to my step. Nobody's looking. I could hold her and kiss her." But he did neither. And when he was sitting alone in the deserted tram, he tore his ticket into shreds and stared gloomily at the corrugated footboard. The next day he sat at his table in the bare upper room for many hours. Before him lay a new pen, a new bottle of ink, and a new emerald exercise. From force of habit he had written at the top of the first page the initial letters of the Jesuit motto, A.M.D.G. On the first line of the page appeared the title of the verses he was trying to write, to E-C- He knew it was right to begin so, for he had seen similar titles in the collected poems of Lord Byron. When he had written this title and drawn an ornamental line underneath, he fell into a daydream and began to draw diagrams on the cover of the book. He saw himself sitting at his table in Bray the morning after the discussion at the Christmas dinner table, trying to write a poem about Parnell on the back of one of his father's second moiety notices. but his brain had then refused to grapple with the theme and, desisting, he had covered the page with the names and addresses of certain of his classmates. Roderick Kickham, John Lawton,